You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 310, Exodus 33-34. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike. How's Florida still treating you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. We are on the brink of starting this school here. So I found out today that we have, you know, by the time I mention it, it's probably climbed again. We have 546 people, you know, students. 400 of them, a little over 400 are online. The rest are going to be Monday and Thursday night. So we're about ready to jump in. Yeah, good times, awesome. You know, going through unseen realm. Yeah, it's just busy, but it's the right kind of busy.
Any other fun things happening in Florida, though? I mean, have you done, seen, adjusted, family, anything? You mentioned to me, is that top secret, what you just mentioned to me about the DOG number 3 eventually?
Oh, yeah, that's, it's not so much of a secret.
Okay.
No, we'd like to get the third pug, but we don't want four dogs, so we're waiting. It sounds so awful. We're waiting for the older one to die. The retriever Atticus. So that's the dog the kids grew up with, so it's a big deal, you know, but he's pushing 12, so but he's made the adjustment really well. You know, he's having a good time actually. It's just he was a little skittish around the pugs. He's been that way for a while, but here he's like, you know, whatever, you know, I'm in Florida now.
Well, I'm glad
it's like a retirement thing for him.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're waiting to get your third pug. Poor guy getting squeezed out.
Yeah. They all can't be pugs, you know, it's just, so
yeah, I hear that,
you know, we're basically settled. We haven't really done anything other than go out to eat. We got a table today. So now we actually have chairs to sit on and a place to eat, but we got one more furniture item that will take another week to get here, and then we'll feel normal.
Did you get a bed yet?
Yep. We've had that for about a week. Got a mattress finally, which is, man, I don't want to rabbit trail too much of this, but boy, did I hate our other mattress. I just despise that thing. What I wanted to do was just take it out in the yard and burn it. Just as a final gesture of contempt. my daughter and her husband love the thing, so we gave it to them. It's like I knew there was something wrong with you, you know. It's just terrible. But now we've everything. Got one.
There you go. Well, Mike, Exodus. This is the second to last episode, so yeah. It's kind of bittersweet. Yeah.
Right. We need the audience to hold back the tears, you know, because we're going to do Exodus 33 and 34 today. And the next episode is going to be 35 through 40. We're wrapping up Exodus because the content of Exodus 35 through 40 is essentially a repetition of chapters 25 through 31. Now, there are differences, and we'll talk about them when we hit that episode. But yeah, this is the second last episode of the book of Exodus. So like I said, hold back the tears. You know, I had to do that earlier this week when I realized that, hey, one more episode. But yeah, that's where we're at.
And don't forget, I already have a lot of questions. And then after that, we'll be doing probably one or two Q&A specifically about the book of Exodus. So we appreciate everybody that sent your questions in. This is your last chance. If you want to send them in to me at treystrickland@gmail.com, that's fine. But Mike, I think we got more than enough questions. So.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Well, that'll ease the pain a little bit of leaving Exodus behind. It'll draw it out a little bit. But, you know, I honestly think it's been good. There's a lot to talk about in the book. So it was a good choice. Just, you know, it's just 40 chapters. So it's a long book, but I think it was well worth it. Well, let's jump in here. Exodus 33 and 34. You know, last time we did say something about Exodus 33. We, you know, hit a number of things in that chapter, but I want to focus attention in this episode on some observations about how chapter 34, you know, builds off chapter 33, specifically the the cleft of the rock experience, you know, when Moses sees the form of Yahweh pass by him, and then of course the effect of Moses and, you know, his shining face and all that. So there's a good bit here to spend some time on in chapter 34, but it of necessity builds off chapter 33. So we want to dip back into 33 a little bit to set up this episode, set up this chapter, chapter 34. So last time, you may recall, we looked at, for instance, Exodus 33:2, which reads as follows. Let me just read that. God says to Moses, "I will send an angel before you. I will drive out the Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites." So we looked at Sarna's observation that the angel reference there, the angel talk, was something different in that verse than we've seen earlier in other places. Exodus 33:2 doesn't say, you know, God doesn't say, "I will send my angel," or "the angel in whom is my name," you know, that kind of description that associates the angel with Yahweh's presence, you know, Yahweh himself in visible form. But instead, in Exodus 33:2, it's just, "I'll send an angel." And that's accompanied, you know, right after he says that, you know, we get the comment, you know, from God, you know, "Go up now. I'm going to send this nondescript angel with you. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people." That's verse 3. So right after verse 2 references, again, this nondescript angel, God says, "I'm not going along." Now, Moses' reaction to all this is uncertainty, both about the mission and the angel. And this seems inconsistent with earlier statements, like in Exodus 23, where God again promised to send, you know, the angel, "and my name is in him," and so on and so forth. It seems inconsistent. Chapter 33 seems inconsistent with that, but it's actually not. And we talked about this last time about why it's not. And again, to review here, since the angel of Exodus 33:2 is not identified as Yahweh's angel, and God doesn't refer to him as my angel or describe him in some way that would associate him with the angel. Since that's the case, Moses doesn't know what to expect. And, you know, you keep reading and in chapter 33, and you get to verse 12, Moses said to the Lord, "See, you say to me, 'Bring up this people,' but you've not let me know who you will send with me." I mean, he's uncertain about, well, who's this dude? You know, what's going on here? So he has this, "I have no idea who you're sending with me" reaction in Exodus 33:12. And that's due to Yahweh's statement that not only does Yahweh not refer to the angel as my angel, but Yahweh specifically says, "I'm not coming along." And so all of that informs us that Moses linked Yahweh's presence to that one specific angel way back in Exodus 23, you know, the one in whom is the name. And this scenario here in Exodus 33 is not the same deal. It's not the same as Exodus 23. And so Moses is uncertain about what to do or who's going along and all that. So it's a strong hint that Moses understood the angel back in Exodus 23 as Yahweh in visible form. And later in Exodus 33:14, you know, we keep reading, God tells Moses that, okay, you know, my presence will go with you. You know, God relents, my presence will go with you. That's an important statement, especially when we get to Isaiah, when we look at, you know, elsewhere for the, you know, passages that have reference to an angel with the journey to the promised land. You hit Isaiah 63:9, and that describes the angel who delivered Israel through the wilderness as, quote, "the angel of God's presence." Okay, so that language specifically associates the presence of God himself with this particular angel. So Isaiah 63:9 and Exodus 33:14 therefore sort of inform each other, once again identifying a specific angel who was Yahweh's angel as Yahweh's presence, Yahweh in visible form. So I'm going to read the rest of that little section where Moses is, you know, he's uncertain. Then God says in verse 14, "My presence will go with you and I will give you rest." And verse 15 through verse 23 reads as follows. "And he said to him," you know, Moses said to God, "if your presence will not go with me, do not bring us up from here. For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not in your going with us so that we are distinct? I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth. And the Lord said to Moses, this very thing that you have spoken, I will do. For you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. And Moses said, please show me your glory. And he said, I will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord, Yahweh. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. But he said, you cannot see my face. Hebrew there is panim. You cannot see my panim. Panai, it says in Hebrew. For man shall not see me and live. And the Lord said, behold, there's a place by me where you shall stand on the rock. And while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back. But my face, my panim, shall not be seen. If we take that, and then we go into Exodus 34, the first 9 verses, here's what we read. The Lord said to Moses, cut for yourself 2 tablets of stone like the first, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets, which you broke. Be ready by the morning, and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai, and present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain. No one shall come up with you, and let no one be seen throughout all the mountain. Let no flocks or herds graze opposite that mountain. So Moses cut 2 tablets of stone like the first, and he rose early in the morning and went up on Mount Sinai, as the Lord had commanded him, and took in his hand 2 tablets of stone. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him. Again, these are all the Lord here. This is all Yahweh in the Hebrew. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, Yahweh, Yahweh, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the children and the children's children to the 3rd and the 4th generation. And Moses quickly bowed his head toward the earth and worshipped. And he said, if now I have found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us. For it is a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us for your inheritance. That's interesting. In that last verse, the word Lord there is not, you know, the divine name, but it's Adonai. So again, Moses, I think that the point there is Moses is, we're supposed to, as readers of the Hebrew text, see a humility there, maybe a fear, you know, Moses afraid to use the divine name there, again, because of what's happening to him. You know, God is right there in his midst, so on and so forth. But there is a change there. But at any rate, again, the description that we're going to focus on today is Yahweh. It's the divine name. Now, notice in all of that, so we've transitioned from chapter 33 into chapter 34. Notice what is said. God has said that my presence, in the Hebrew is panai, it's the word panim with a suffixed ending, first common singular suffixed ending, my presence, panai, I will go before Moses and Israel. So, you know, this is how God, this is what he says, my presence is going to go before Moses and Israel. Moses, in response to that, you know, when God relents and says, okay, I am going to go along after all, my presence is going to go with you. Moses' response is that he wants to see God's glory. Okay, the word there is kavod. So we need to take note of what God said is going to happen. My presence will go with you. And then we want to note what Moses asks for. Please show me your kavod. You show me your glory. God never actually affirms in what follows that that is what Moses is going to see. You would never read in the rest of the passage that Moses saw the kavod of the Lord. He doesn't. You know, he sees something else, and he sees Yahweh in this human form. You know, and he experiences the presence that way, but he never sees the glory. He never sees the kavod. So God never affirms that that's what Moses is going to get. He's not going to get what he asked for. He'll get something, but he won't get what he asked for. But he does promise Moses that his goodness will pass before him. We know God is referring to passing before Moses in visible form, even when he says, my goodness is going to pass, you know, before you. We know that God is telegraphing the fact that it's going to be a visible presence, a visible form, because he tells Moses that he will cover or shield Moses with his hand so that Moses can only see his back parts. So, you know, again, let's just think about what we're seeing here. God says, my presence is going to go with you. Moses is feeling good, you know, about things now. And he says, you know, he wants to see God's glory, his kavod. And God, in effect, by his answer, says, no, you can't see the kavod. You're not going to see the kavod. You're not going to see my glory, but my goodness will pass before you. Meaning, again, this visible form, because in effect, when my goodness passes before you, I'm going to put you in this cleft of the rock and I'm going to cover you with my hand. And then I'm going to remove my hand and you're going to see my back parts. Again, so there's an equation there of the presence which Moses is allowed to experience, and he's going to experience on the trip to the promised land anyway, and he's already experienced it, you know, before, with this, again, anthropomorphic, this human visible form of Yahweh. There's a difference between those things that are allowable and what is not allowable. Okay, what is not allowable is seeing the kavod, the glory. And so there's two ways to experience God's presence in this passage. When God's essence, you know, when his glory, okay, when the presence, when God himself is filtered or covered or concealed or obscured by virtue of showing up as a man, and when it's not, okay, the one is accessible and allowable and permissible and won't result in Moses dying, okay? The other one would. So the other one is not going to happen. And this is important because, you know, when God says how, when he describes how Moses is going to experience him, he describes what's going to happen. You're going to see me, you know, in this visible human form. Then he says, but my presence cannot be seen. That's Exodus 33, 20. And 23. You know, the English translations will read, my face you cannot see. And so it creates this impression that God, you know, God doesn't want Moses to see a human face. You know, God is appearing as a man, and you're allowed to see the back parts and the hand. You're allowed to see anything but the face. Okay. That works in a lot of passages where, you know, biblical scholars like to refer to the divine man, Yahweh, as the divine man. Like in Ezekiel 1, where he's seated on a throne, you see his, you know, from the waist down, you see his legs and his feet. Exodus 24 was another example. You see the feet, you know, of the Lord, but you never see the face, the panim. The difficulty with looking at things that way, though, is you have to imagine that when Yahweh showed up as a man with Abraham, with the two angels, the three quote-unquote men, and they have a meal, that somehow Abraham never looked at that one man's face. And, you know, the text never says that. You have to imagine that to be the case, and you have to come up with some mental scenario as to how you can have a meal with three guys and never see the one's face. You know, it's kind of difficult. It's also difficult, you know, when Abraham and God have that conversation about Sodom, really? Like they never looked at each other, you know, in the face? You know, and you say, well, you know, what about the phrase, you know, that God and Moses conversed face to face? What's the problem here? You know, again, the word face in translated in English is panim. It can mean face, like a human, you know, you're the featured, you know, thing on top of your shoulders there, between your ears, or it can just mean presence. Panim to panim, it was an idiom to basically say two people were present with each other having a conversation. And the assumption is when that happens, when people have conversations, they're looking at each other. And I would say that's normal. That's correct. And so I think that Abraham could have had a face-to-face conversation with Yahweh in human form. And the same for Moses, and the same, you know, for Abraham in Genesis 19, as well as Genesis 18. I don't think that's really what's being forbidden here, because I think you can come up with other passages where it makes sense that God showed up as a man. Joshua chapter 5, the captain of the Lord's host, it's the same thing. It really defies logic that they can have a conversation and the human person in the episode never sees the face of the other one. I don't think that's a contradiction here to God saying, my face cannot be seen, my panim cannot be seen. And the reference to, you're going to have to look at the back parts. I think what's going on here is the language is used to communicate the idea that what can't be seen is the glory. Because this is what Moses asks for, and God never tells him that's what he's getting, and the text never says that's what he got. In fact, God deflects it. He doesn't say in response, oh, okay, or no, you can't see that. He's going to say, here's what's going to happen, Moses. My goodness is going to pass before you. You know, and we know in Exodus 34 what happens, okay, you know, that we have Yahweh in human form. He shields Moses with his hand until he passes by, and then Moses can see the rest of him. I think that whole episode is designed to communicate what cannot be seen, and what cannot be seen is the glory. I don't think it's a contradiction, or that it creates a contradiction in some of these other passages where God does show up as a man and people do have conversations. You know, we can't basically take the divine man passages like Exodus 24, where you only see the feet, or Ezekiel 1, you only see the loins and the feet. We can't retroject those onto these and come up with these weird scenarios about Abraham and Joshua and Moses having conversations with God where somehow they never look at his face. I mean, people do that, but again, the reason they do that is this passage right here, Exodus 34, where God says, my face. You know, they're reading it. First of all, people are reading it, the passage in English, but he says, you know, my face cannot be seen, you know, lest you die. I think what we have here is a way of communicating the idea that people can and did experience the presence, the panim, when God showed up as a man. But what they can't see, what God forbids for their own good, is the unfiltered presence, that is the glory. Okay, that is what they are not allowed. Moses is not allowed to encounter that in this immediate, pardon the language here, face-to-face way. That is something God will not allow to happen, because Moses would die. And frankly, if God isn't filtered in some way, if he is not made accessible to the human senses, you're not going to know what you're looking at anyway. What, a bright light? You know, or, you know, like, what's that? You know, well, it's a bright light. Yeah, I know, but what? I want to see God. Well, there you go. You know, I mean, you can't really process a person, a personal entity, as being light. And so what God has to do is come to humans. This is the consistent pattern of Scripture, informs that they understand what they're looking at. And most often, not always, but most often, this is coming to them in human form. And that they are allowed to experience. And biblical characters do have face-to-face discussions, you know, with God in that way. So the way, you know, that we sort of sort all this out to make sense of it is there's what Moses is allowed to see, and the way that it transpires here with the whole back parts thing. You know, you cannot see my panim and live, but I'm going to let you see my back parts. That's designed to communicate to the reader, okay, to the reader, the notion that there's a way to experience God's presence when he's in human form, but you cannot experience the presence without that. Okay? You cannot just experience the glory, because you would die. And again, I think we get to that understanding by seeing how God doesn't answer Moses' request. There's a way he does answer it, and there's a way he doesn't answer it. He deflects it. Okay, you can't see the glory. You can see me in a certain way, but you can't see the glory. So I've been asked this question a lot, you know, in Q&A, and this episode actually gives us a little bit of a chance to sort of park on it. But this is how I think, you know, Exodus 34 needs to be understood in relation to Exodus 33, and not only Exodus 23, not only seeing this particular angel in other passages. The people do see the angel. Okay, Joshua does see the captain of the Lord's host. Abraham did see Yahweh in human form. I mean, the way to create consistency, or the way to, you know, see consistency in all these passages is to do something like I just did and say that what God deflects Moses away from, what he is not allowed to experience, the way he is not allowed to experience the panim, the presence, is direct contact with the glory. That's just not going to happen because you'll die. Not only will you not know what you're looking at, but you're going to die. So this is how, again, I'm not unique here, but I think this is, again, the way that we need to put all these things together. So this leads me, and again, it's not just me, the other scholars here who would say the same thing. It leads me to believe that while Moses did see the angel in the bush, and presumably both he and the other Israelites saw the angel of Yahweh, like, protecting them, blocking the Egyptians and the whole, you know, Exodus, you know, the Red Sea crossing. And, you know, if the angel is out there leading them to the land, other people are going to see him. So while Moses and Israel do see the angel of Yahweh, they see Yahweh in human form, no mortal ever saw or could see the pure, unfiltered glory of God. So we don't need to speculate again that Moses and Israelites, you know, always saw the angel of the Lord from some oblique angle, or he had a hood on, or, you know, a face mask, or, you know, we don't have to, you know, speculate on these things. It's not necessary. If we realize that panim is the Hebrew word behind face, and panim is the Hebrew word, same Hebrew word behind presence, and that sometimes the presence of God can be apprehended, can be seen. And other times it can't. I think the way we divide those things up coherently is to say what cannot be experienced is the glory. So no mortal could see God as he truly is, unfiltered by visual convention. Personally, I think this is why the name is presented as I am that I am. God just is. He is ultimately completely other. He has no analogy. Okay, if you were to encounter the unfiltered presence of God, you wouldn't know what to do with it. You have no way of processing it. It just is what it is, and good luck. You know, there's no way to process who God is, what God is, you know, all those sorts of things. And so when he reveals his name, I am. You know, what does that mean? Well, it means I am. I'm incomparable. I can't compare myself to any other thing because I'm not like any other thing. So for people to know, both in biblical days, you know, and again, for the sake of, you know, later readers of the text, you know, this is how it has to be done. You know, God has to come to humans. He has to condescend to them and come in a form that they can process. And that's allowable. And humans are safe doing that. You know, they're not going to die when it happens. But if it was just the unfiltered glory, that's just going to end badly and it wouldn't matter anyway because nobody's going to figure out what that is. Now, a couple other textual notes related to Exodus 34. I just want to go through the passage and highlight a few things. And, you know, we'll sort of loop back, you know, into this, you know, experience of Yahweh here with a couple of them. In verses 6 and 7, let's go, you know, look at verses 6 and 7 again. So Exodus 34. 6 and 7, the Lord passed before him, Yahweh passed before him and proclaimed, Yahweh, Yahweh, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the children and the children's children to the third and the fourth generation. Now, Sarna writes about these two verses this. Just going to give you a few things he says and then comment on them. He says the subject of the two verbs in verse 6, the Lord passed before him and proclaimed. Okay, who's the subject of the word proclaimed? Grammatically, it could be the Lord passing before him and the Lord proclaiming the Lord, or it could be Moses. The Lord passed before him and Moses proclaimed the Lord, okay? You could take it grammatically either way. So the subject of the verbs here may either be Moses or, Sarna says, as verses 2 and verse 2 and chapter 33, verse 21 indicate, or God. And I think actually Exodus 33:19 is the key here. If we read Exodus 33:19, he said, you know, God is speaking to Moses, I will make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim before you my name, the Lord. So I think the best way to take this is that we need to let Exodus 33:19 inform our reading. You know, some people don't like the Lord passing before Moses and the Lord referring to himself in the third person. They just think that's weird. Or, you know, first of all, it happens a lot in Scripture where God refers to God in the third person. So it's not, you know, that unusual. So it's no real problem. So we don't have to come up with a way to get around the problem by saying, oh, it's Moses doing the proclaiming. Well, grammatically you can do that. But again, 33:19 ought to inform our reading. It's very clear there. There are two first person verbs and God says, I will do this and I will proclaim. So I think that should sort of end the debate there in chapter 34. The Sarna goes on to talk about the phrase, you know, compassionate and gracious, or a God merciful and gracious is the way the ESV has. He says, now, the order of these two things is different than you get in the Decalogue, Exodus 20, verses 5 and 6. And again, it seems to Sarna, and I would agree with this, that not only do you have, you know, a bit of a difference just in terms of the way things are laid out, but you really have a difference in content. So here, God is compassionate and gracious. There, you know, God says, I, the Lord God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the children, you know, so on and so forth, you know, showing steadfast love to thousands who love me and keep my commandments. So that there's compassion and grace and love shown in the Decalogue, but the description of God is different than here. I mean, here you have God being sort of magnanimous. What's highlighted is his magnanimous qualities rather than his willingness to judge in Exodus 20. And I think it's interesting and honestly appropriate that here, when God reveals himself and you get similar language to what you find in Exodus 20, here, if you will, the positives, again, the magnanimous qualities are highlighted. I think that's especially interesting and appropriate because what has just happened? The golden calf incident. So, you know, there's really no need for God to say, I'm a jealous God and I'm willing to punish, you know, when it's necessary and all that kind of stuff. Here, the emphasis is on mercy and grace. And that's going to become important because we're leading up to the covenant renewal. So it's a way, again, for God and, again, for the writer as well, obviously, to get people thinking in the right direction, get Moses assured again that the covenant's going to be remade, and get, you know, the reader again to know that God, you know, has, you know, forgiven. He's still going to be, you know, in covenant relationship, you know, with the Israelites after the golden calf. And so, you know, God is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, so on and so forth. And then you get the language from Exodus 20. So I think that's worth, again, pointing out the covenant is going to get renewed, you know, starting with verse 10 and following the rest of the chapter. And so it's sort of set up by this description of God. Sarna has another thing to say about the language here. You know, ESV has steadfast love and faithfulness. Sarna translates these things as kindness and faithfulness, and then extending kindness, you know, keeping steadfast love in the ESV. He writes this, the Hebrew here is chesed ve'emet, okay, steadfast love and faithfulness. The Hebrew chesed ve'emet appears frequently as a word pair to express a single concept. Each of the components has a wide range of meaning. Chesed involves acts of beneficence, mutuality, and often also obligations that flow from a legal relationship. Emet, usually translated truth, encompasses reliability, durability, and faithfulness. The combination of terms expresses God's absolute and eternal dependability in dispensing his benefactions. On extending kindness, or again, in the ESV, you know, keeping steadfast love. Sarner writes, the phrase may express either God's continuous and unchanging chesed, or the idea that the merit for the chesed that people perform endures beyond their own generation. So, you know, you have, I think, again, the way to read this is really, you know, the first part of what Sarner, you know, concludes here. What we have here is in the description of God, not only is God willing to not leave the covenant relationship, but he's also both capable and has obligated himself and is willing to obligate himself to be loyal to it. You know, chesed elsewhere it gets both translated and described as loving loyalty, which I think, again, it feels kind of clunky, but it's still a good way to communicate the idea of the word. To have that mentioned, you know, here really twice, that God is chesed ve'emet. He's full of, you know, the steadfast love and faithfulness, and he extends chesed. Again, pointing to the fact that God is reliable, durable. He's going to keep the covenant no matter what, even though we've just had this golden calf thing happen. So again, it's important, again, to set up the covenant renewal starting, it's going to start in a few verses in verse 10. What about the phrase, will by no means clear the guilty? You know, I think this phrase has led to a lot of misunderstanding, you know, generational cursing and all this sort of stuff. I think it fundamentally misunderstands what's going on here. Now Sarna, we'll just let him chime in here. If you go to the passage and we look at the language, okay? Yes, the Lord, you know, forgives iniquity and transgression and sin, but he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. Sarna writes, divine forbearance does not mean that sinners can expect wholly to escape the consequences of their misdeeds. Now, let me just stop there. Who gets punished? Okay. If they're guilty, the ones who are guilty are going to get punished. But God is yet this magnanimously merciful and gracious God. Okay. So what Sarna is saying here is, you know, it might be easy for somebody to read that description and think, wow, you know, God is so big and so capable and so willing to forgive that when we do something wrong and there is judgment, there still won't be consequences. God will reverse that or skip that part or that's just not going to happen. And so Sarna is saying, no, you know, this idea is really not correct, you know, to draw from this passage. You know, the idea is really more, and Sarna, you know, quotes some, you know, some rabbinical sources for this, that would say that the idea here is that God remits punishment for the penitent, but not for the impenitent. And you say, well, maybe, you know, makes sense, but can you really get that from the text? Again, people can argue about that. I think if we keep going, I think it sort of brings that idea more into focus and gives it more justification. This notion of visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the children, the children's children to the third and the fourth generation, that statement, we've talked about this before on the podcast, but might as well get into it here again. The statement doesn't mean that the innocent, you know, the next generation, the children, the offspring that extend from the guilty, okay? It doesn't mean that the innocent children are punished for their ancestors' sins. That's actually specifically contradicted in the Decalogue. Okay, in Exodus 20, verses 5 and 6. Okay, you shall not bow down to them, to other gods, or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children of the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. I mean, there the language is clearer that, yeah, if you, you know, well, I'll use the language of the passage. If you hate the Lord, okay, if you're going to be disobedient, you know, just like your ancestors were, then this whole thing's going to follow you. You will deserve, you know, judgment. But for those who love the Lord, you know, he will show steadfast love, you know, to thousands who love me and keep my commandments. So there's a little bit of a of a further characterization there, I think, that helps. And it's the same in Deuteronomy 5, 9, and 10. I won't read that one, but it's the Decalogue in Deuteronomy. I would also say that the statement also isn't intended to outline some sort of chronology of cursing. When it comes right down to it, the statement is intended to draw attention to the fact that God does not keep punishing. Now, Enns, I think, in his commentary, says this in an interesting and helpful way. When he comments on the phrase, "and his mercy extends to thousands of generations," Enns writes, "whereas God does visit punishment on offenders only to the third and fourth generations." So let me just rephrase that. Let me just say that again. Enns is highlighting the fact that we have a contrast going on. God's mercy extends to thousands of generations. Deuteronomy 7, 9, for instance. "Know therefore that the Lord your God is God, the faithful God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments to a thousand generations." You know, we just looked at that language in Exodus 20, the Decalogue, showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. So in regard to those who love the Lord, God's mercy is shown to thousands and thousands and thousands of generations. But when it comes to the guilty, God doesn't keep punishing for thousands and thousands and thousands of generations. Instead, the effect of the offender's sin only extends to the third and fourth generations. So it's actually a contrast that points out that God doesn't keep punishing. It has a very clear limitation, whereas his mercy doesn't have any limitations. The third and fourth generation is actually an idiomatic expression to express the idea, basically for the duration of the guilty party's life. So third and fourth generation is essentially the time span that it would take for a person who, let's say they committed some offense as an adult, they're 20, 30 years old. Well, by the third and fourth generation, that person, that's the rest of the length of that person's lifespan. Because a generation, you know, this generation defined as child, you know, children reach childbearing age. You know, they get married and have other children. And in biblical days, that's 20 to 25 years. So basically what this is saying is that, look, when you have someone who is guilty and hates the Lord, again, to use the language of the Decalogue, and bears the punishment for their sins, that punishment, God's judgment, as it were, and the consequences of that judgment are only going to last really as long as that person's normal lifespan would last. It doesn't keep going through future generations. The only thing that keeps going on and on and on and on and on is mercy. So these passages actually teach the opposite of what I often hear about generational cursing, at least trying to tie that concept to biblical language. Again, the point is a contrast. Go to Deuteronomy 7, 9. Go to Exodus 20, verses 5 and 6. Deuteronomy 5, 9 through 10, the larger passage there. And you'll find out that what goes on for thousands and thousands of generations is mercy. But judgment and the consequences of judgment, you know, you have somebody's sin and their whole family, people who are innocent, suffer the consequences of what somebody did. They're not being punished as though they did it, because God doesn't punish the innocent. But yet, the fact that when God does punish the guilty, their punishment affects the lives of other people, especially within their family there and their extended family. God says, look, that's going to be limited. You know, three, four generations, that person is gone. There's limitations there. But what isn't limited is mercy. So when God's people sin, God's punishment will not extend beyond the life of the offender. It'll only extend three or four generations, basically the course of that person's natural life. God's anger, therefore, has definite limitations, whereas his mercy is limitless. That's the point. So again, we need to stop looking at this kind of passage and inverting it 180 degrees to, you know, suspect that third and fourth generation somehow means that the innocent are punished well beyond the offender's lifetime, three or four eras down the road. That is not what it means. Now we get into verse 10 in Exodus 34. This is where we get the covenant renewed. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you get language here that it's drawn from the Decalogue passage, the original covenant. I'm making a covenant with you, you know, verse 10, before all your people, I will do marvels such as I have not been created in all the earth or in any nation. And all the people among whom you are shall see the work of the Lord, for it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. And then God says, I'm going to drive out your enemies. Take care lest you make covenant with the inhabitants of the land. Don't do that. Verse 13, you shall tear down their altars and break their pillars and cut down their Asherim, for you shall worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. You know, and again, things you don't do. Don't make covenants with the inhabitants of the land when you get in there. Don't eat of their sacrifices. Don't sacrifice to their gods. Don't take of their daughters for your sons and their daughters, you know, their daughters, you know, whore after their other gods and make your sons whore after those gods. You know, don't do that. Then in verse 17, you shall not make for yourself any gods of cast metal. It's exactly the same term as used in Exodus 33, 4 and verse 8 for the golden calf. And the point is clear. You know, we talked about this in the golden calf episodes. Yahweh will not be worshipped in the manner that other gods are worshipped. Don't do that. Sarna chimes in here and says, mindful of the people's sin, the renewed covenant contains stricter admonitions than those given before. I mean, there are things added, especially the little reference there to the golden calf. There are stricter admonitions than those before regarding the incursions of foreign cults into the religion of Israel. Pacts with the indigenous peoples of Canaan are prohibited because of their deleterious consequences, religious corruption, intermarriage, and the resultant undermining of national religious integrity. If Israel is to be distinguished from every people on the face of the earth, Exodus 33:16, this is what Moses, you know, just said, the fact that you're with us is what distinguishes us, okay? If Israel is supposed to be distinguished, Sarna writes, then it must make itself distinctive by unswerving and exclusive loyalty to its covenant relationship with God. Then he goes on to comment on sacred posts, Asherim in Hebrew. These are cultic, pagan objects often mentioned in the Bible. They derive their name from the goddess known in Babylon as Ashrat, consort of the god Amuru, which is the Amorites. She bears the titles Bride of the King of Heaven and Mistress of Sexual Vigor and Rejoicing. At Ugarit, she appears as Athirat, consort of Il or El, who was the head of its pantheon. And she is termed the progenitrix of the gods or mother of the gods and Lady Athirat of the sea. She was a fertility goddess, and in 2 Kings 23:7, she is associated with sacred prostitution. The text testifies to the assimilation to Canaanite culture on the part of a segment of the Israelite population, a reality demonstrated by an inscription from Kuntelet Ashrud in northwestern Sinai that mentions Yahweh and his Asherah. I want to do a little brief rabbit trail here because I sometimes get questions in email about, hey, Mike, don't you realize that Yahweh of the God of Israel had a wife or a consort. There's this inscription, from Kuntelet Ashrud that mentions Yahweh and his Asherah. So well, duh, we had to translate those in grad school. Yes, I'm completely aware of them. But I think you're not aware of a few things. Again, the people who think this is something. I want to do a little bit of a rabbit trail here on this inscription, the Kuntelet Ashrud inscription, and there are several of these from that place, and then there are other inscriptions that have the same wording. Kibbut El Kom, comes to mind. There's one there as well. I'm going to quote, again, an authority here, somebody who's done a lot of work on this, and that's Rick Hess. We've had him on the podcast before. We interviewed him as part of the SBL interviews 2 years ago. Rick, this is sort of, in his wheelhouse. He does inscriptions and archaeology as an Old Testament scholar. And I'm going to quote from his book, Israelite Religions, subtitle, An Archaeological and Biblical Survey. And this is a 2007 book, and this comes from page 284. So I'm going to just, you know, read, and we'll see what the issues are here. In the eyes of some scholars, this is the most significant set of texts, Quintilat Ashrud, yet discovered for understanding Israelite religion. These important inscriptions mention Yahweh and Asherah as deities invoked in the pronouncement of blessings on various people. El and Baal are also mentioned in a single poem. However, the interpretation of these texts bristles with problems. Elsewhere, I have argued that the mention of Asherah in conjunction with Yahweh is not a cult symbol, nor is, quote, his Asherah, unquote, the best translation. Instead, it is preferable to render the goddess's name as Asherata, in accordance with the spelling and reading of her name everywhere outside the Bible for more than 1,000 years. The tradition of reading and pronouncing this name as Asherah is one that derives directly from the Bible. In the translations below, for the sake of accuracy, I will render the goddess's name as Asherata. However, I will continue to use Asherah in the text of this study, since it is the most commonly accepted way of spelling the name of the goddess. Now, that's the end of the quote. What he's talking about here is, if you actually look at the inscription, you have this doesn't really translate well visually, but essentially you have the Aleph, the Sheen, the Resh, okay, and then you've got the H, and then you've got a T and another H, okay. So the issue is the last consonant, that other H. It could be a suffix, with third masculine singular suffix in epigraphic Hebrew, which means his. Okay, so you have the Athirat or Asherah, and then his on the end, his Asherah. But what Hess has just noted, though, is that the actual spelling here of this name in all sources outside, I'll quote him, everywhere outside the Bible for more than 1,000 years, the T and the H, okay, at the end, it's not a suffix. It's a proper name, Asherata. So what he's saying is you should be translating this Yahweh and Asherata, not Yahweh and his Asherah, like his wife. Now, that doesn't mean that whoever made this inscription wasn't thinking of them as a couple. Okay, Hess is going to say they probably were. But out of the gate, his Asherah, as Hess points out, and you know other scholars have as well, that's really not the right translation. So that's just point number one. Now, he goes on to elaborate on these inscriptions, and he says this, who or what is Asherata in these inscriptions? Four options have been suggested. It's a symbol of Yahweh. Number two, a personal name of the goddess Asherah. Number three, a symbol of Asherah. Or four, the personal name of the goddess Asherah, Asherata, more accurately. And then he writes that Asherah is a symbol of Yahweh is not impossible. There are some scholars, let me just jump in here. I mean, when we did these inscriptions in grad school, you know, we had to read a bunch of articles on these things, and some think that Asherah is actually a term that is used for a place. It sounds weird, but like a cultic threshold or place of sacrifice, or a symbol, a symbol of a deity, not the deity itself, but a symbol of a deity. And Hess is saying that's not impossible. However, it is unknown in Israel for Yahweh to have a cult symbol. Keel and Eulinger propose a cult symbol subordinated to Yahweh. In this interpretation, the Asherah symbol is no goddess. As developed by Miller, Asherah became a symbol of Yahweh who expresses his presence, a kind of hypostasis that possesses no gender but only the presence of God. With Hadley, these are all scholars who've studied Asherah. With Hadley, he sees in her an anticipation of Lady Wisdom in Proverbs and the development of the law as a personification of God. However, this view, this just generally that Asherah or Asherata is a symbol of Yahweh, suffers from several problems. Smith, this is Mark Smith, argues that the references that associate Asherah with Baal, Judges 3:7, 1 Kings 18:19, for instance, must all be discounted as late editorials and glosses by the Deuteronomists. So Smith is saying, look, earlier in Israelite religion, you know, Asherah was the consort, you know, of Yahweh, and these verses that make Asherah the consort of Baal, they were added later to sort of clean up the theology. And Hess is objecting that. He says, why would the Deuteronomists, again, this is the Deuteronomistic ideas, material written essentially in the 7th century BC, in the wake of the problem of idolatry in Israel, when Josiah and others were trying to get rid of idolatry, that the way certain passages in the book of Kings, for instance, you know, were written, testifies to the fact that, you know, Israel was idolatrous and we're trying to clean it up, you know, that sort of thing. So when we see Deuteronomists, this is what they're talking about. And it gets that name because a lot of scholars think Deuteronomy was written at this time as well. It's not Mosaic. It was written at this time as well for a variety of reasons. But anyway, we're not going to rabbit trail into that. But what Hess is saying is, look, if we assume this picture that we've got a bunch of biblical writers, we'll call them Deuteronomists, writing, you know, at this time, trying to deal with the idolatry, why, he asks, would the Deuteronomists defeat their own purposes of monotheism by rehabilitating a forgotten goddess? Why would they bring her back into the picture? Nor is the text's failure to mention Asherah in Jehu's reform of 2 Kings 9 and 10 proof that this deity or hypostasis was acceptable to the Yahwist Jehu. Rather, the emphasis on Baal includes all the deities in his pantheon, such as Asherah, and only occasionally did the biblical writers feel the need to specify them and give them the quote-unquote honor of naming them. A second problem arises with the 12th century BC Babylonian text, in which the names of many gods are subsumed under one deity, Marduk, who is the chief god of Babylon. However, and everybody, Hess is saying, look, everybody knows about this text, where all the deities in Babylon at this time were subsumed into Marduk. However, Marduk's wife's name is missing. She's not named in that text. This is no oversight, Hess says, but a demonstration of the fact that the female goddess was never assimilated into the male deity, even in such a polytheistic context. This evidence argues against the view that Asherah was or became a stand-in, a hypostasis of Yahweh. He goes on, there's evidence for the continuous presence of Asherah in the West Semitic pantheon from 2000 BC on to the Persian period without any textual suggestion of her becoming again a stand-in or hypostasis of any male deity, so on and so forth. And you know, he goes on and he critiques, you know, all these different possibilities. And he writes this. He says, my view assumes that Asherah Ta here is the personal name of the goddess. In this scenario, the final H consonant in the inscription spelling of the name could be a second feminine ending. Sorry for the grammar talk, but for those of you who know a little bit of Hebrew grammar, you'll follow this. It could either be a second feminine ending or a vowel letter reflecting a final A vowel. In the latter case, the name is not Asherah, but Asherah Ta. This is the preferred explanation, based as it is on comparative forms in Iron Age names of southern Palestine and on all other West Semitic occurrences of the deity's name from the second millennium and the Iron Age epigraphy of the first millennium BC. Asherah, as spelled as it is in the Bible, is never found in extra-biblical texts of the monarchy in Israel. At Kirbet El-Kom and on an ostraca from 7th century BC Tel Mikne, or Ekron, the spelling Asherah Ta is always found. Thus, I think the deity was Asherah Ta, identical to the Asherah of the Bible, only spelled differently. So what does this mean? What do the data actually tell us? And here's where we went, why I rabbit trailed on this. As Hess noted, again, there were one or two writers, I'm going to quote Hess here again. He writes of the Kirbet, or the Kuntalet Ajrut inscription. At least one or two writers of this graffiti from Samaria had a view of their god that allowed for other deities, a perspective reflected as well in the prophets. Now, what does that mean? He's saying something I said, you know, a week or two ago. Look, for sure, some Israelites living during the monarchy or at other times would have thought poorly about their theology, about the theology of the biblical writers. You know, even before we had biblical material, of course there are going to be some Israelites that think like Canaanites do. oh, we have a deity. His name's Yahweh, and he has a wife. All the other deities around here have wives, so why wouldn't he? You know, they're going to think these thoughts. It's going to be normal for certain Israelites to think about Yahweh like other people think about their gods and having a divine couple and all this kind of stuff. Absolutely, somebody's going to be thinking that thought. And apparently, as Hess says, well, at least a couple writers did, because we have these inscriptions, Yahweh and his Asherita, or Yahweh and Asherita. There's a pairing. There's a divine couple here. At least two Israelites thought this way. But it's not coherent to presume that a majority of Israelites thought this way based upon these inscriptions. It's not coherent to presume a majority of Israelites thought that Yahweh had a consort, much less than to say that the biblical writers thought this way. That conclusion is a non sequitur. It is a conclusion which does not follow the data. It is an overreach of the existing data. But for sure, some Israelites, that was their theology, divine couple. Every other deity has a wife, so Yahweh has one too. And Asherah, okay? Or Asherita. For sure, some Israelites had that as their theology. Guess what? The Old Testament tells us that and calls it wrong. Okay? It calls it apostate. That's basically what we know. But you're going to go out on the internet and you're going to see people reference these inscriptions. And, you know, then Mike's going to get the email, like, again, somebody went out on the internet and discovered something that you know, I've never heard of in relation to, you know, Yahweh and Israelite religion. I'm sorry, but you're not going to do that. This is what grad school is for, okay? So, yes, we know about these inscriptions, but for you to take one inscription and to presume that, well, the writer thought this, so everybody did. The writer thought this, so the biblical writers really thought this, and then they tried to erase it and obscure it, and you know, this conspiratorial hermeneutic. Look, I got news for you, friend. You can't. Christians, we have an entire Bible, and we've had it for 2,000 years. Christians disagree on all sorts of theological subjects from the same Bible. People do not all think the same way, even when they want to identify with the same thing or the same belief system. That's just life. So your view, your assumption that we have an inscription out here that says Yahweh and Asherita, a divine couple, that must really be what the biblical writers thought, is just nonsense. It is a non sequitur, a conclusion that does not follow from the data and in fact overreaches the data. Nothing else in life works that way, okay? Especially, you know, in a field like religious, you know, belief systems, or people don't all think the same thoughts. It is so obvious as to be self-evident. You know, for those of you out there who are thinking, you know, like that, it's like, look, you can't even find the people living under the same roof as you to agree on everything. They're just not going to do that. That is not the way people are. It's not the way life is. And we have no reason to suspect, based upon a couple of inscriptions, that this divine couple, the idea of a divine couple, was official Israelite religion of the biblical writers. We have no reason at all to think that. That is just poor thinking. Sorry, but that's what it is. So lastly, as we wrap up this episode, the one episode here in the last few verses, Exodus 34, 29 through 35, this is the shining face of Moses. We'll do this and we'll end. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand as he came down from the mountain, Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking with God. Aaron and all the people of Israel saw Moses, and behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the leaders of the congregation returned to him, and Moses talked with them. Afterward, all the people of Israel came near, and he commanded them all that the Lord had spoken with him in Mount Sinai. When Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. Whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would remove the veil until he came out, so on and so forth. So we have this episode of Moses, you know, shining face, and Sarner writes this. The first half of this verse is the scriptural way of describing Moses' withdrawal into solitude at the onset of his mystical spiritual experience on the mountain. In the presence of the ultimate source of holiness and in communication with him, Moses realizes a transformation of his self. He achieves a state that is beyond the ordinary range of human experience. You go down a little bit. Having succeeded in his mission as an intercessor, Moses descends the mountain, carrying the two inscribed tablets that testify to the reality of the renewed covenant between God and Israel. The idea of radiance. Sarna writes, this was a unique phenomenon conveyed by a unique Hebrew term, karan, that's K-A-R-A-N. The traditional meaning given here is favored by the context and by Habakkuk 3:4, in which karnaim, rays of light, appears in parallelism with a brilliant light. This reference relates to God, and numerous biblical passages bear witness to a widespread poetic notion of God being enveloped in light. Moses' radiance is a reflection of the divine radiance. Similar imagery was in use in ancient Mesopotamia, where an encompassing, awe-inspiring luminosity, known as melamu, was taken to be a characteristic attribute of divinity. This supernatural radiance was thought to be shared by royalty and was a sign of the king's legitimacy. The present narrative about Moses shows that this notion was not considered to be incompatible with Israelite monotheism, although it appears in the Bible only in connection with Moses. The peculiar threefold use of karan, K-A-R-A-N, rather than the regular verb aleph, vav, resh, that's or, to shine. The peculiar use of karan to convey this shining, as opposed to the verb or, to shine, to give light, is probably a pointed allusion to the golden calf. Sarna writes, why? Why? Because the noun keren, K-E-R-E-N, is the usual word for horn. It subtly emphasizes that the true mediator between God and Israel was not the fabricated, lifeless image of the horned animal, as the people thought, but the living Moses, and who had been with God. The association of karan with keren gave rise to the mistaken notion that Moses grew horns. Even though the text speaks not of his head, but of, quote, the skin of his face, unquote. The rendering of karan by Cornuta in the Vulgate, the Latin Vulgate translation, based on the commentaries of Jerome, helped foster the error, and a horned Moses later became a familiar figure in art from the 11th century onward. The most famous such portrayal is, of course, Michelangelo's at San Pietro in Vincoli, Rome. The awe-inspiring radiance emitted by Moses' face may be understood as the afterglow of the refulgent splendor of the divine presence. And I just wanted to read you a little bit of that because, you know, you've probably seen that picture, Michelangelo, you know, his Moses and Moses' horns. This is where it comes from. It comes from an error perpetuated in the Latin Vulgate, you know, which was the Bible of most of the church at Rome, anyway, you know, for centuries. And because it rendered the verb mistakenly that way, you know, it saw karan and thought of the noun karen, horn, and so it's a mistranslation. So again, that's a bit of trivia, but I actually like Sarna's observation that karan is a verb. It's unusual. It's probably in the text here in Exodus 34, rather than the normal verb or, to give light, just to play off the golden calf, the horned calf, the horned bull or ox. I think that's a nice touch, and I think that has some coherence as to why the writer would have chosen this vocabulary as opposed to the more normal, you know, terminology. I want to end the episode here by something that Sarna writes in this section. He says, again, this awe-inspiring radiance functions to reaffirm and legitimate the prophet's role as the peerless intimate of God, the sole and single mediator between God and his people. It also testifies to the restoration of divine favor to Israel. As such, the narrative forms a fitting conclusion to the entire episode of the golden calf. It further serves as an appropriate transition to the last segment of the book of Exodus, the account of the construction of the mobile tabernacle, that is to symbolize the presence of God in the camp of Israel. And we're going to end there, but I like that quote because if you wonder why in the world, this is just one reason, we're going to get into it in the last episode next time when we cover chapters 35 through 40. But if you wonder, well, why in the world do we have the construction of the tabernacle in chapters 35 through 40, which essentially repeats the instructions given in Exodus 25 through 31. You know, we get the instructions there, and then we get like the carrying out of the instructions in the last five chapters. One of the reasons is just what Sarna said there. The fact that we get it before the golden calf is obvious because God has entered into a covenant with Israel, given him the law, and all this wonderful stuff is going on. And God is going to dwell with his people after the golden calf. The fact that all of it is essentially reiterated is part of the testimony that God is still going to live with his people. Nothing's changed. You know, God is faithful. He is the, you know, merciful, showing kindness from generation to generation to generation. So it's a way actually to bookend, you know, the material is bookended on either side of the golden calf episode to make the point that the covenant has been restored.
Yeah, Mike, that's really interesting about Da Vinci's depiction the horns, of Moses of horn, you know, with the horns and stuff. So did Moses just have a really good suntan or what? I mean, was he glowing? I mean, yeah, can you give a little bit more description?
I think that's the point, that his skin shone, there was a radiance. If you want to call it glowing, you know, go ahead. If that communicates it well, I think that's the idea, but he did not have horns.
Yeah, just a really good suntan.
It's really weird, you know, how I mean, Jerome lived roughly 350 into the 400s AD. Okay, so you're talking about centuries and centuries and centuries of people using the Latin Vulgate and reading that passage and thinking that Moses had horns, and it's entirely wrong. It's a translation fabrication. But I mean, nobody knew that. It was just that's the way it is. It's amazing to see how long a bad translation could last. So remember that next time somebody questions you about Deuteronomy 32:8. Well, you know, my Bible doesn't say sons of God there. Well, that's because we didn't have the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, yeah, that kind of thing actually happens. It happens that translations aren't what they should be for various reasons. You know, in this case, it was a difficult term. Probably should have looked at Habakkuk and, you know, drawn the right conclusion, but Jerome didn't. In Deuteronomy's case, it's just a lack of having the correct text. But this kind of thing does happen on occasion.
And I also had a question about 34:14, where it says, "You shall worship no other god, for the Lord whose name is jealous." Anything there to unpack?
I like the wording there because let's go back and look at it. You know, whose name is jealous? I mean, isn't that interesting? God actually isn't named jealous. You know, like if God's filling out a job application, he doesn't put the word jealous in there. But the fact that his name is jealous, remember, his name is another way of referring to himself, his person, his essence, who he is, you know, and what he is. So if we remember that the notion that the name is another way of referring to God himself, it doesn't mean that he's named this. It's that he is this. You know, he is a God that will not share his glory with somebody else, with some other deity. And it points to it's another good verse for establishing that the name is a way of referring to God himself.
All right, Mike, that sounds good to me. We appreciate it. And with one episode to go to cover in Exodus, don't forget, send me your questions if you have any. And also, don't forget to go to nakedbibletours.com to sign up to get on the cruise, because Mike and I would really love to meet you and see you on the cruise. It would be a lot of fun. With that, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.